We left off yesterday in the middle of a Mishala from the Gemara where a non-Jew was walking past the Beis Medrash and he heard them talking about the clothes of the Kohen Gadol, and he was awe-inspired about, wow, what great vestments, clothing these are. Couple of interesting things, okay? I wonder how we understood Hebrew. That was the first question, right? And so he said, oh, I want to wear that, so let me see if I can become the Kohen Gadol. We're told that he went first to Shammai, and Shammai said to him very quickly, you can't, you got to be a Kohen, and even if you convert, you'll never be a Kohen. So take a hike, Mike, basically. Quite abruptly dismissed him. Hillel said to him, you can't just be a Kohen Gadol. You got to learn, you got to understand. This is not something you just get appointed to. You need to go through a period of training and learning. And so the Jews, this guy started learning. And when he started learning, he became a Yid. He became enthralled with Torah generally. And when he got to the part that he learned, Hazor HaKarayv Yamus, that nobody who's not a Kohen can go into the Beis HaMikdash, he understood that not even David HaMelech, right? The Melech HaMoshiach, they can't be a Kohen. So, achas kama v'kama, how much more so did he realize that he couldn't reach this? And then he went back to Shammai, right? And he said to him, it's only because of Hillel's forbearance, because Hillel was kind, because Hillel told me to learn, that I'm here today. If for you, I'd still be a shaygus.
They don't give you what he said to him.
Right? So, my friend says, we could stop for a minute and say, hold on. What about the way Hillel approached him? He says, we can give him great kudos that he did not act in a quick-tempered manner, right? And didn't try to basically get rid of the guy 1, 2, 3. But was he really straightforward? When you tell the guy, go and learn about it, was he sort of giving a hint that it was an attainable goal? And why was he being so coy? And tell him, go sit and learn, with the thought in mind that he would one day realize he can't become the Kohen Gadol. Rabbi Franz says, this Gemara teaches a life lesson. He said, anybody who's trying to teach anything to anyone has got to pick a time when the listener will be responsive. He says, and he's been a Rebbe forever, right? Maybe 50 years. He says, there are times that a student will accept what I say, and there are times he won't. He's just whatever, not in the mood, not in the mindset, etc. And he said, if I want to give him an important lesson, I've got to pick the time and place. I've got to ensure that he's in the mental and psychological state that he can accept the message. He said, had Hillel told this person, I'm sorry, there's no way you can become a Kohen Gadol, the individual would likely had the same reaction as he would have to Shammai. He wouldn't feel put down, right? But he might feel deeply disappointed and, you know, might have a specific resentment towards Judaism. Hillel's wisdom indicated to him that he had to have the fellow learn. He had to learn about the truth in what my friend calls a non-threatening environment. And he said, my friend says, oftentimes it's better to have people study in what he calls an intellectual academic context. You're not being hit with fire and brimstone. You're being told the Mishnah Berurah says, the Rambam says, etc. Right? The person can pick up this sefer. He can go maybe get a Shulchan Aruch and look at it and say, oh, what is this? And he may, in some cases, actually find out there's certain reasons why the rules are such as they are. And if he can't find out the reason, he can be led to the concept of a chayk, that which HaKadosh Baruch Hu has dictated and didn't give us the reasons. And therefore, it is easier for the individual to accept the message. Now, my friend goes on and he says, there are many times, hey, especially with children, where you want to teach them a lesson, a parent, a grandparent, you want to get them to do something, to correct something they're doing. And he says, you've got to make sure they're ready. He says, let's go to the absurd. We can't teach a two-year-old to read Rashi. We can't take a six-year-old baby and teach him to run. He said, it doesn't work that way. He says, for someone to be taught anything, they really do have to be on the intellectual, mental level and the physical ability to implement that which they realize. He says, the Gemara is giving a message to teachers, to rebbeim, to parents. You've got to know where and when to deliver a message that teaches a given point. Hillel realized that this individual who was in front of him had the potential to be a Ger Tzedek. And he knew that the only way to get him to face the reality was to do it in a pleasant, non-threatening manner. Okay. We look at the components in the Big Day Kahuna, in the clothing worn by the Kohanim, right? Which we learned yesterday were lechavoid ultiferes, for honor and glory. And now my friend says, the Kohanim were the so-called palace guard, because the palace of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was the Mishkan, the Beis HaMikdash. And he said, there's two, he calls them unique anomalies in the making of the Big Day Kahuna, the clothing. The first anomaly is that they were required to contain shatness. We have, generally, a forbidden mixture of wool and linen. They can't be together. And that's why we have shatness labs, etc., to make sure that our clothing doesn't want it, because shatness is the same issur as is eating pork. It says, if someone were to daven wearing, let's say, a shatness garment, his prayer, it says, is rejected for 40 days. That's one of those, you know, enigmatic memories that we have. But it's an indication how HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not want shatness to be on the body of the majority of the Jewish people. But Kohanim were not only allowed to, they were commanded to wear it. He says a second anomaly in the mitzvah is that Bigdei Kohuna were required to have hidur. They had to be beautified. We know that we have hidur mitzvah that we talk about, get a beautiful lulav, get a beautiful pair of tefillin with all the chumras, have a beautiful esrog, have a beautiful Hanukkah, right, menorah. He says, but that's always an add-on. He says, if we don't have this beautification, we do not have a failure to be mekayim to do the mitzvah. With the Bigdei Kohuna, the specific hidur, the specific beauty had to be in the garments. If they weren't technically beautiful, they couldn't be used. And if the Kohen wore them, it was an Isser. Therefore, we're told that if a Kohen knowingly wore a ripped or soiled garment, it says, he's chayiv misa at the hand of heaven. Misa bidei shamayim. Right? Which stresses the importance of this notion of hidur, of this perfect garment. And my friend says, there's no other such mitzvah in the Torah that it's got to be beautiful ad abnitio from the beginning. He says, Rav Avigdor Nemnesol, the chief rabbi of the old city of Yerushalayim, talks about this. And he said, let's first look at what caused the forbidden aspect of wool and linen. He says, yes, we know it's a chayk. It's one of those things like a para duma. We don't have a reason. But he says, the Zohar says that this prohibition was to commemorate the original murder when Cain killed Hevel. It said Cain was the first person to think about bringing a korban. No one else had done it. And he went and he got inferior linen from his flax. Hevel brought an offering of wool from his sheep, but he got the very finest, the best he had. Cain, we know, had his offering rejected by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He became jealous of his brother, and he killed him. He said, this incident of woolen linen was an aspect. It might have caused, he says, the first murder. And it's something that we therefore get a choik not to wear together. And my friend says, what in fact was Cain's problem? Why did he take inferior flax? The Mephilas Yeshurim says Cain's error was that he did not think the form in which you serve Hashem makes a difference. It's the substance. I tried to give a korban. That's what counts. The fact that it's a hot dog and not a steak makes no difference. It doesn't matter how you do the mitzvah, just do it. Mesilas Yesharim says, Kayin is being told, you're wrong. That's not always true. In some cases, yes, but when you want to serve the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, then it's got to be pristine. It's got to be perfect. When you serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the substance of doing the mitzvah and the very form are important and must be complied with. My friend says, when we are invited to a chasna of good friends and we write a check to the chasen kala, we attach a note. We attach terms of endearment, letting them know that we're glad to be able to share in their simcha, and it's akin to honoring them. He said, can you imagine if a chasen and kala open up a check? It's $100 and it says wedding. He says it's nice, but it's not the same type of delivery. That was Kayin's problem. He doesn't understand that the form in the way a mitzvah being done for Hashem really matters. If you're doing a mitzvah, hiddur is important. To the extent you can beautify it, it does matter. Granted, as we said, in other cases, you still have the mitzvah, but in the case of the Kohen Gadol in God's palace, in the connection between heaven and earth, it had to be perfect. He says, the correction for this was the Big Day Kahuna. The Big Day Kahuna were worn by a Kohen doing Hashem's Avodah. This was somebody acting already in the perfect manner, right? And therefore, hiddur's important, but you don't need to worry any longer about, we'd call it, the contentious juxtaposition of wool and linen. There's no, when you're doing Hashem's mitzvahs in the Beis HaMikdash properly, you need not worry about unwarranted machloikas, unwarranted disputes. And since the Big Day Kahuna now represent the antithesis of Kayin's action, right? That it's being done perfectly, we need not worry about shotness. This week is Moshe Rabbeinu's yahrzeit, Zion Adar. Every year, Zion Adar falls out of the Parsha of Tetzaveh. There's one Parsha in the Torah where Moshe's name is not written, Tetzaveh, the very Parsha we read in the week of his yahrzeit. We're told that when after the Egel, Aveira occurred, Moshe said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, either forgive Jewish people, umecheni noy mesifracha. If not, erase my name from the Torah. And we're told that when a tzaddik says something, even conditionally, right, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will keep it, even if this seems to be a curse, right? It's going to be fulfilled. And this omission of Moshe's name in this parsha, which deals with Aaron and his children and their avodah, is the fulfillment of that statement by Moshe Rabbeinu. The Bala Turim says Moshe pleaded on behalf of Klal Yisroel. Moshe pleaded that there continue to be a Jewish people. And in his chus, we exist. He says, a parish called Sukkos David says, the Zohar said that if Noach had had the same approach to the impending Mabul, the flood, as Moshe had at the time after the Egel sin was committed, the flood would have never happened. Moshe acted in the most heroic of fashions possible, and yet his reward is that his name is taken out of a parsha. The Sukkos David says, I'm going to tell you the truth. Removing Moshe's name from this parsha is in fact not a punishment. It is the greatest tribute to the Mesiras Nefesh, to the self-sacrifice of Moshe Rabbeinu on behalf of Klal Yisroel. Moshe Rabbeinu knew that when he said Mecheni na Misifracha, it was going to happen. In other words, had Moshe's words truly come to be, his name might not have occurred anywhere in the Torah. But Moshe made the decision, I don't care. My honor is nothing in comparison to the required survival of Klal Yisroel. That's what's important. There are two places in the Torah where the Torah gives accolades, shvach, about Moshe Rabbeinu. One is in Bahaloscha, after Miriam and Aaron talk about Moshe and what they appear to be the problematic relationship he has with Zipporah, his wife, where the Torah says he's the most honest of all people. And then in Zosa Bracha, where it says, Lekom b'Yisrael k'Moshe oid. Moshe was unique. There never was and never will be anybody who reaches the status of Moshe Rabbeinu. And Rabbi Fran says, seemingly, if you were to ask someone about Koray, where is the greatest testimony to Moshe Rabbeinu, they would say, either Bahaloscha or Zaysa Bracha. The Bala Turim is saying, no. There's a third parsha that speaks volumes about the amazing character and qualities of Moshe Rabbeinu. Parshas Tetzava shows how much Moshe Rabbeinu loved the Jewish people. He loved them so much, he was willing to have his name omitted from the entire Torah if that was what was required to save them from the sin of the Egel. Parshas Tetzava gives us, quote, the silent edus, the silent testimony to the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. It shows us the ultimate self-sacrifice of the greatest leader the Jewish people ever had. And he says, it's not ironic. It's definitely appropriate, and it's definitely by plan that Moshe's name is not mentioned in the same parsha that occurs on the week of his yahrzeit. And Rabbi Frantz has often said, halavai leaders everywhere would take lessons from someone like Moshe Rabbeinu. The idea that leaders should have, quote, no hidden agendas, no ego, etc. And obviously no one else can rise to Moshe's status, but that's the model. It's the golden model for all of Klal Yisroel to see as to what a true leader of Klal Yisroel is.